Hello, and welcome to IEP Essentials Pro Tips Podcast, brought to you by Learning Essentials. Learning Essentials offers special education-based tutoring in your home by state-certified educators with advanced degrees in all areas of special education. IEP Essentials Pro Tips Podcast brings professionals together to educate and empower families navigating special education needs in the IEP process.
And thank you for joining us today for IEP Essentials Pro Tips Podcast. Our episode today will focus on autism, anxiety, and ADHD. I am your host, Wendy Taylor. Today's conversation is with Dr. Dan Shapiro. He's a developmental and behavioral pediatrician. I've had the pleasure of hearing Dr. Shapiro speak several times and am fascinated with the complexity that revolves around individuals with autism, ADHD, and anxiety, and hoping that our chat today will shed some light on these kiddos and how to better understand them and to better support them. Dr. Dan Shapiro attended medical school at George Washington University. His pediatric residency training was at Children's Hospital in Washington, D.C. He practiced pediatric and adolescent medicine in Silver Spring, Maryland for 13 years. Before he had shifted his entire focus to developmental and behavioral pediatrics. He enjoys seeing children and consulting in his home office and dozen of area schools in and outside of Washington, D.C. He's developed the Parent-Child Journey, which is a parent group. It's a training program. And he's the author of two books, Parent-Child Journey, An Individualized Approach to Raising Your Challenging Child. And his newest book, Parenting Child Excursions, ADHD, Anxiety, and Autism. He's a fellow of the American Academy of Pediatrics and a member in the Society for Developmental Pediatrics. Thank you, Dr. Shapiro, so much for joining us today. I appreciate your time and coming on Pro Tips Podcast and having this conversation and discussion with us to help professionals and families alike really kind of try to sort out autism, ADHD, and anxiety. And I know this is a big conversation to pack into an hour, but we're going to do the best we can. And so when we think about autism, anxiety, and ADHD, really they're on the opposite ends of the spectrum. When I think about it, just as an educator, looking through that special education lens and thinking about students that I've supported both in and out of the classroom. So can you just tell us what is similar and what is different about autism, ADHD, and anxiety?
Well, thanks for having me, Wendy. This should be fun and a very, very important, interesting topic. So, when we think in terms of diagnostic categories, developmental differences seem very different. But I'm going to be making a case today for moving beyond the diagnosis of autism, the diagnosis of ADHD, the diagnosis of anxiety, and think in very different terms beyond these categories to what we call functional assessment. And we're going to be looking at actually what's going on in the brain, how different people process information, how they behave, and maybe give people a different way of looking at things. So, I think it's helpful to start with a little bit of simple brain physiology. And if you can think of, by way of background information here, a little about two different systems in the brain. There's the excitatory system in the brain where you're too uninhibited. So if you're playing Simon Says and Simon does not say, raise your hand, you might shoot it up anyhow if you're too uninhibited. This is typical for people who get a diagnosis of ADHD. I didn't inhibit myself well enough, Simon didn't say. On the other hand, you can be too inhibited. So Simon might say, raise your hand, but you hold it down by your side. You're too inhibited. You're looking around, seeing if everybody else has raised their hand first. And so if you're too uninhibited, you might commit errors of commission. If you're too inhibited, you might commit errors of omission. And so we think about this spectrum of inhibitory control with people who have the brakes on too tight and the brakes are too loose. And think about ADHD, anxiety, and autism in those terms, and it'll shed a different light on things. So we used to say that ADHD and autism couldn't be diagnosed in the same person. And that's turns out to be pretty ridiculous because they so often travel together. Since 2013, with the new edition of DSM, the powers that be decided that, well, yeah, we can diagnose them together in the same person. And they often travel together, autism, anxiety, and ADHD. So getting to your question, when these things coexist and we think about ADHD and anxiety and autism in terms of self-control, how inhibited or uninhibited you are, let's think on the one hand of ADHD as a problem of under-inhibition and anxiety and many aspects of autism as being over-inhibited. Let me explain that a bit more. So if with ADHD you're distractible and have poor focus, with anxiety and autism, you perseverate, you hyper-focus. With ADHD, the brakes are on too loose. With anxiety and autism, they're on too tight. With ADHD, your gears shift too easily. And with anxiety and autism, you get stuck in one gear. With ADHD, it's like, the impulsivity, the preference for new things. It's very different than in anxiety and autism, where there's inflexibility and you prefer repetition and ritual. Just to complete the list here, with ADHD, you tend to leap before looking. You can have some dangerous behaviors. There are safety issues. With anxiety and autism, often you're taking a step back. You're avoiding. You're shutting down. You're playing it safe. With ADHD, too much in the moment, here and now. With anxiety and autism, you're living too much in the past or too much in the future. And with ADHD, you're focusing on too many things instead of one. With anxiety and autism, you're focusing on one thing to the exclusion of others. So as you said, these things seem so different. But the deal is you can have both tendencies, being over-inhibited and under-inhibited in the same person. It depends on the task, the situation, the setting. For example, somebody with autism might appear to be acting more ADHD, more impulsive and distractible if it's a auditory verbal situation like sitting in circle time or a classroom or even around the dinner table. But the same person might appear more anxious and stuck for visual motor activities more hyper-focused. Like, let's say you're playing Legos. You could maintain focus forever. So this is what I call flipping between tendencies, between a tendency to get stuck and a tendency not to be stuck enough. So I'm painting a picture of complexity here because apparently opposing tendencies can travel in the same person and flip around depending on what you're doing in that particular moment. So a long-winded introduction to the complexity here, but I hope it's helpful to think about this spectrum of inhibition. And it helps us move beyond, again, just the diagnostic categories.
Right. And then how do you even get to that point of, as I'm listening to you, I really love the analogy of the brakes being too tight, the brakes being too loose. I think that's a really good, that's really lovely imagery for professionals and parents working with a child that is complex in their appearance. How do we start that process of, I always try to think in an organized fashion. So would you recommend parents just kind of listing through, how do you even get to the point of finding somebody that can say, yes, these do coexist? And, comorbidity is challenging, right? To kind of sieve out what is one and what's the other. And, I guess what I'm hearing from you, maybe I'm asking a question and then answering some of it at the same time, is that the diagnosis is part of it, but it's what we do next with it.
Yeah. So here we need to get practical. So your neuropsychologist, or educational psychologist, your developmental pediatrician, those are the folks who make the the diagnoses of autism, ADHD, and anxiety. But then, you know, what do we do? Here's where I like to just think about the child's typical day. And they wake up in the morning. How do they go through the morning routine? Is that in a stuck way or an unstuck way? A distractible, impulsive way or a hyper-focusing, not shifting the gears way? And then once we get through the morning routine, including meals, how do we transition to school? Are there different trigger points during the school day that obviously are examples of over-inhibition or under-inhibition? When we transition home for after-school activities, for evening activities, for weekend activities, we look at challenging situations and analyze one situation at a time. What parts of the child's profile, what facets of the child's profile seem to be most relevant to a child's failure or success in a given situation? One child could be super distractible getting through the morning routine, and that'll be one set of strategies. But then you take the same child who really just wants to do one thing once they get to school and not shift with the class from one activity to another to another. And that'll take a different kind of strategic thinking. So we think about problem situations, not one tendency carved in stone that is at play all day long, 7 days of the week.
Right. And so just looking at the patterns, the places, are these skills transferring, not transferring? If they're not, where is that occurring? And then really analyzing that to say, okay, well, how do we support? And I would imagine from the practitioner that is starting the conversation with the family really would benefit from asking a lot more deeper questions.
Yep. So you want to really paint a picture of a typical day. And what goes well and why does that go well? What is it about your child that represents a good fit for that setting, for those tasks? When is there some difficulty? When is your child frustrated? When are you frustrated? When does the child fail to meet reasonable expectations? And why might that be? What is it about the child? So what we're talking about today is just one facet of a child's profile, how under-inhibited or over-inhibited they are. But then, you know, there's all these other facets as well. You know, how about their sensory profile? What about their learning for profile, language processing and language production, fine motor skills, gross motor skills, environmental stresses, you know, how well they read the room, their social skills, and so on and so on. So every problem situation gets analyzed in terms of all the different aspects of a child's profile. And this talk of over-inhibition, under-inhibition is just one piece to the puzzle. An interesting piece, a really useful piece, but it sure doesn't represent comprehensive assessment or management. I'm just focusing on that to emphasize the point that we need to move well beyond the diagnosis of autism or anxiety or ADHD to have a more nuanced view of a child and really be in a position to do more individualized setting and task-specific management.
And that's so incredibly true, right? In terms of just looking at those nuances and then exploring how those nuances impact or don't impact a child during their day to really kind of work together as a team to ensure that that child's being successful and across all environments, whether it's just learning at home, socially, emotionally, really to fully support that child. And so how do families find a doctor that can help with this with lots of experience in treating these coexisting conditions? And, you know, I've had families really kind of just lost in trying to figure out what's the best way to support their kiddo. And so from your experience, how do families find doctors? You know, what's their starting point? What are they asking for? What are they looking for? And sometimes when we're looking as parents, we don't always know the questions to ask.
Yeah. Well, it depends on what you need. So if you need a doctor to make a categorical diagnosis, does your child have ADHD? Does your child have anxiety? Does your child have autism? Then any number of people can help with that. For autism, a developmental pediatrician, a neurologist, a psychologist, certain specially trained speech language pathologists. So if you're looking for a category of diagnosis, it's because you want to get some services for your child. You want to make them eligible within the school system for a 504 or an IEP plan. You want to get some health insurance reimbursement. You want to have a common language with which to speak, so parents and clinicians and teachers and the child themselves can understand in general what's going on. For funding, for driving research, for communication, for binding people in support groups, you need a diagnosis often of ADHD, anxiety, and autism. So that's one kind of assessment. Issues like what is there anything underneath it all causing the autism or the ADHD or the anxiety? This can result in a bit of a wild goose chase, but especially in autism, the standard recommendation is to at least think about having a genetics evaluation to see if there's Fragile X, for example, to see about a whole range of other genetic differences that might explain where the autism comes from. This can be important for research, for family counseling, but it doesn't really guide management. What really guides management and what we're talking about today is so-called functional assessment. And that's usually a neuropsychologist, an educational psychologist, a school psychologist kind of moves beyond the categories, moves beyond what might be causing issues and splits apart the child's profile instead of a lumping approach. And you want to describe what's going on with language, what's going on with motor skills, what's going on with sensory, what's going on with social functioning, what's going on with mood. Again, how about the child's environment? What about goodness of fit between the child and the school? These are generally psychologists, special educators, speech language therapists, occupational therapists, sometimes each person evaluating their piece of the puzzle. And it does often take a team, an interdisciplinary approach to really understand the whole child. And it can be daunting for the most savvy of parents. It is good to identify a case manager. Some general pediatricians are very attuned to these issues. Others, not as much. So there are any number of people who can serve as case manager. It can be a person on the school team. It can be a special educator, a speech language therapist, usually you want somebody with general experience so they can see the whole thing and not just the parts. There are special education, special needs navigators now, and in our community, there's some excellent ones.
That's right, there is, and I was just thinking that in terms of that, the special needs navigator approach, that liaison approach in terms of working with families, you know, with a variety of needs and these complex comorbidity conditions and are these complex conditions and trying to figure out what is the impact and really having somebody that can be that main person for your team to really interact and have help with these conversations between the multiple professionals that are evaluating and supporting a child is really imperative. And I know, I've said this before in terms of helping families that oftentimes it's really working in a silo in terms of the educational has their approach and their recommendations and the medical field has their approach and their recommendations. And oftentimes these fields aren't really conversing with each other. So if you, it's so important. So if you're a parent with a child that has really just needs that whole team approach, having somebody in your arena that can help case manage, that can help lead, that can help navigate these systems for a parent and really help them understand what to ask. Because oftentimes when you're in the forest, it's hard to see the trees and it's hard to know what to ask. And as a parent, you're so emotionally involved and attached. And so really to put that kind of thinking hat on versus the emotional hat and then juggling life in general becomes exhausting. So really, absolutely, back to your point, in terms of having a care navigator, someone that can really help with that case management, guide you in those conversations, and make those recommendations of, you know, evaluations, and then looking at the approach of what can we do now with these strengths and needs.
So that person doesn't have to be a world's expert. That can be just somebody who really, really cares about your child and about your family and is in a position to provide some continuity of care over time. So, you know, it's good to just be explicit with the one person you've encountered who you feel you can trust. And say, hey, I would like you to be my care coordinator. I'd like you to be my case manager. Is that something you can do? I need a quarterback. I can't do this by myself. And let that person self-identify being in that role rather than just thinking that they have only an isolated part to play.
And that's it's really, you know, to have that person do that and have that communication and that contact with that person to really, you know, coordinate appointments and hospital stays and school's absences, you know, to collaborate, whether that's referring for counseling or medical issues or managing the side effects or coping, you know, and then providing that consultation component between the parents and the school and the medical team, and then helping them with all of this information to devise educational and medical plans at school so that the school-aged child can be successful in their environment as well. And I know that's a lot of what the Power Up by Learning Essentials side does for its families, is acts as this liaison with the training and the coordination and the collaboration and consulting with other people.
Absolutely.
And so, you know, once we have all this information in terms of what is the impact and looking at all of these areas, how do parents and educators stay on top of this nuanced treatment? Because sometimes it is, and sometimes it involves medication and other, you know, behavioral interventions. What should educators do to observe? What is your recommendation? Because I know you play that case management role with your families that you see. And so how do you kind of help them manage and sufficiently those nuanced treatment trials that you may be implementing, and what would be the next step after fact-finding and gathering this information?
Well, there are some things we do for children that are very, very setting and task-specific. And that tends to be behavior management, educational strategies, and that can be parent and teacher centered, or it can involve the child directly if they're capable of thinking strategically about their day. We want to skill everybody up in that kind of problem situation management. And then there are some interventions that cut across situations and tasks. One obvious one would be medication, where that's on board throughout the day. And that's a whole different set of issues. So we need to do both. We need to think, well, hey, if we had one magic wand, what would we wave it over in terms of the child's profile? For example, would we wave it over their ADHD tendencies? Would we wave it over their anxiety? Would we wave it over certain aspects of learning where we really want an expert special educator like yourself getting in the trenches and doing that hard work of skill building over time?
So really kind of prioritizing, right?
Yep,
so
exactly.
Once you got a diagnosis, then you've pulled in individuals that can help say, all right, here's our strengths, here's our needs. Again, whatever that team is comprised of, and then looking at now what? How do we prioritize? What is that magic wand? What are the top three things that are providing the biggest impacts for this child throughout their day. And then making that educated step.
Exactly. You can't have 10 magic wands. Costs too much money. You don't have the energy or the time to fix everything. And not everything needs fixing. So I think you said it beautifully. You know, what are the priorities? And it's better to do a few things really, really, really well. Really bring it. You know, the intensity, the focus. Better to do that than doing a lot of things poorly. And I see families going to 5 million specialists and having the kids assessed over and over and over again. And what they need is somebody to help them choose a magic wand or two, or at most three, and really go for those core issues. Yeah. So that's child by child going to be different.
It's going to be different. And I think really what a gift for a parent, for somebody to say, all right, let's hit pause. Let's look at the information we have. Mm-hmm. Let's kind of comb through what we have. Let's refer back to the conversations that we've had about this specific child. And let's see what is, you know, how do we prioritize? And, you know, start with that first one and then kind of make your way down. But it really is that constant cycle of coming back and saying, all right, well, we've learned skills here, we've stabilized this area. Okay, how can we continue to improve? And then ultimately, that would be the way to success, right? So you're kind of taking these baby steps instead of frantically going in 20 different directions.
Yep. You know, you know, being unrealistic about how quickly things can change. Some folks, understandably, are looking for something that will instantly make everything all better. And that magic bullet rarely exists. So we have to, as you say, take the baby steps approach, the brick by brick approach, and break down our goals to sub-goals. And then when we take that one step in the right direction, well, that's a success. And then it leads to another. If we swing for home runs, whether it's with medication management or certain therapies or educational goals, often we strike out. Sometimes it's better to just go for that single or double, get on base, and then move the runner along. Forgive the baseball metaphor for those of you who are not baseball fans. But we want to go for solid progress and not get sucked in to overly wishful thinking.
Yeah, and I like that. You know, you talk about singles and not home runs, and I think that's a really just a good metaphor for life in general, right? Because it is can be overwhelming, and just what can we do well? What can we build? If we were to look at the medication avenue for these kiddos with ADHD, anxiety, and autism, what are your thoughts on that? And how do you go about that with your families?
Yeah. So, you know, if you have coexisting ADHD and anxiety, which is very, very often the case in autism, then we ask the family, well, which is the bigger deal? And we ask the teachers and we observe the child ourselves. And, you know, some families will say, oh, well, if only we got the distractibility and hyperactivity and impulsivity under better control, wow, that would make all the difference in the world. And there'd be less anxiety because the child would be experiencing more success. So let's go for the ADHD first. Other families would say, well, you know, really the anxiety is the bigger deal. I think that's what we should go for first. And in fact, the child's so anxious, that's what makes it hard for them to focus. That's what makes them impulsive, is because they're uncomfortable in a situation. Let's go for that first. But a lot of families, you ask, which is the bigger deal, the anxiety or the ADHD? And they say, yeah, I'm not sure. We've got you know, both of them going on. I need two magic wands here. And then, you know, it's an educated guess which to go after first. But usually we'll combine, you know, everybody's opinions and take a vote basically across settings and see which is the bigger deal. If in doubt, we tend to treat ADHD first, because medication is first-line treatment for ADHD. cognitive behavioral therapy, not medication, is first-line treatment for anxiety. So when in doubt, treat the ADHD first, and ADHD medicines tend to work faster as well. So whatever we're targeting, what we want to do is start with baseline ratings of target symptoms. Let's say we're treating the ADHD. Well, we'd ask parents and teachers and the child, if they're old enough, to say, hey, 0, 1, 2, or 3. No problem, little, medium, or big problem for each of the targets. 0, 1, 2, 3 for distractibility. 0, 1, 2, 3 for impulsivity. 0, 1, 2, 3 for getting things done, et cetera, down the usual symptom of the list of ADHD symptoms. And we'd also ask at baseline, what's the predisposition to any of the common side effects? At baseline, before medication, 0, 1, 2, 3, how is your child with eating, sleeping? Are there tics? Is there irritability? Let's make sure before we start medication that we understand where we're starting from. And then we start with a tiny little dose of ADHD medicine, and that's a whole other discussion. Again, swinging for singles, and see if those target symptom ratings come down, if the medicine's doing what it's supposed to do, great, if there are no side effects. If, on the other hand, side effects kick in before benefits, then we have to try something else. And on my website, parentchildjourney.com, you can go to resources and find medication trial scales that lay out for you how to do these baseline and follow-up ratings for ADHD symptoms, for anxiety symptoms, and see how that all works. But the idea is to gradually scooch up the dose of ADHD medicine so that you're giving just enough to fix the impulsivity and distractibility, but not so much. You don't want to overshoot, because that could actually amplify the autism or anxiety. So if ADHD medicines are about making the brakes looser, making them tighter. For ADHD, you want to tighten up the brakes, stop and think. You don't want to make them so tight that you become, if you will, more autistic or more anxious. So the most common side effects of stimulants when you over-treat ADHD are really irritability, inflexibility, social withdrawal, the kinds of things we would see without medication in anxiety and autism. And just on the other hand, if you're treating anxiety with Prozac, Zoloft, Lexapro, these kinds of serotonin medications to fix the rigidity and distress, like your brakes are too tight, we want to give just enough so that you loosen those brakes, but not so much that you amplify the ADHD and make the brakes too loose. Because the most common side effects of anxiety medicines are losing inhibition, getting overactivated, basically amplifying your ADHD. So there's this balance to strike, this golden mean, this middle ground where you don't have too much inhibition, you don't have too little inhibition. You're treating the anxiety and the ADHD tendencies each just enough so that you have the right balance in terms of self-control. So it can be tricky, and you need to go bit by bit, single, not home run, so you don't cause side effects. But that's the general idea when you've got these coexisting conditions.
Can we just step back and just, you had mentioned your website and what was on it, and can we just kind of revisit that for folks that are listening and the value that helps? Because as you're talking and as a practitioner, how do you ensure, like, how do, the assessment of is it working, is it not, in a more real-time experience versus, all right, let's start this in a micro dose and then come back in a month and self-report what's happening. I feel certain that you take a little more thoughtful approach in that manner. And so when you mentioned what was on your site, I'd like to just kind of revisit that and say, what can we do during these trials to ensure that we're really following what's working and what's not.
Yeah. So don't do this on your own.
No, you do want to
be under the supervision of an experienced prescriber. And that can be a general pediatrician who's sophisticated about these issues. And don't underestimate your pediatrician. A lot of them are really good with this stuff. But specialists, child psychiatrists, developmental behavioral pediatricians are for sure going to be well-versed in these issues. And so under the care and supervision of a professional, I hope that the materials on my website are useful supplements. So again, if you go to parentchildjourney.com and go to resources and scroll on down, you'll find a bunch of things you can click on. So, for example, if you're treating with stimulant medication for ADHD, you can hit on stimulants. If you're using serotonergic medicines, the SSRI, selective serotonin reuptake inhibitors like Prozac, Zoloft, Lexapro, you can hit on serotonergics. And up will pop the treatment trial rating scales where you can list those target symptoms. Hey, what are we trying to make better? And you can see a list of the most common possible side effects. Hey, what do we want to monitor for? And for stimulant medication for ADHD, you don't wait a month. You can see day by day, those medicines kick in right away. Mm-hmm. And, at most a week, at most. But, just a few days at a time, you can tell if you are at too low a dose and need to increase because nothing's happening, or at a dose that's too high for your child because side effects are happening before benefits, or hopefully just right, where your target symptoms are all better and there are no significant side effects. So this gets assessed with stimulant medication for ADHD, at least a few times a week, and there should be very, very regular communication between parents, teachers, and prescribers, with parents and teachers and the child themselves. Don't forget about them. Have them be an active participant in their own treatment trial when they're old enough to do it, or simplify my scales so that they're in a more age-appropriate format for the child. You pool everybody's data at least once a week and say, hey, which bucket are we in? Too much medicine, too little? Or just right. It's a Goldilocks project. And hopefully we find the just right balance when we're treating the ADHD symptoms. If necessary, moving on to the anxiety symptoms, it's the same logic. But with anxiety medicines, that we need to take at least 1 week at a time, if not longer, to give those medicines the time they need to kick in. Anxiety medicines, we generally assess week by week. ADHD stimulant medications, sometimes we can assess even day by day with good communication between the school and the parents and the prescriber.
And you know what I have found to be helpful with that, kind of with the good communication piece, is opening up a Google Doc and having just so it's really easy. It's all working in real time that the parent can hop on. They can add their information. The teacher can add their information. The professional that is administering or prescribing can then see this process in real time. And it just seems to be a little smoother and organized than shooting emails back and forth, because then you just get this trail and you're not sure what started when. And
I think that's a great suggestion. And my treatment trial forms can be put in Google Doc format. And I found that to be incredibly helpful too, Wendy. Great suggestion.
So we talk about medication, and then how do we balance that with other treatments, and what other treatment options are available? You had noted that, about behavioral interventions, and are there other treatment options that you would like to share with us that may be of help for families out there?
Yeah. So I mentioned in passing that medication is first line treatment for ADHD, but medication is not first line treatment for anxiety. A first-line treatment for anxiety is cognitive behavioral therapy, where we get parents and children to recognize when their thoughts aren't accurately representing reality. There can be catastrophizing, there can be perfectionism, there can be all or none thinking. Anxiety is really about making mountains out of molehills. So the cognitive piece of cognitive behavioral therapy is working with the parents and the child to just catch themselves misrepresenting how serious the problem is, you know, what's the likelihood of dying if you step outside and there's a bug on the ground. Let's get real about that risk. And then the behavioral part is the most important part, and it's the part that's usually not done as well. People will talk a lot about anxiety, but it's the facing your fears piece that is really where we get wonderful control over anxiety. I, for example, have a hard time getting on airplanes. And if I avoid airplane travel, which I do my best to do, but my wife and my family and other commitments sometimes require me to get on airplanes. And if I face my fear and use some strategies, I realize that, I can do this safely. It doesn't drop out of the sky. Bombs don't go off. And I can unlearn my fear through experience. So the more I fly, the less anxious I am the next time around. If I only get on an airplane once every 2 years, all those old anxieties just have a way of bubbling back up. So a good cognitive behavioral therapist will make a list with the child and the family. Hey, what are your anxiety triggers? What are the situations that tend to be anxiety provoking? And let's go for the easiest exposures first. So if your fear of flying is a 10, but your fear of going to the park and maybe there being a spider there is a 2, let's start with the park and the spider. Practice those skills on things that are relatively easy, low-hanging fruit first. And then once you learn that you can overcome the easier things, then you work your way up. And so this is, the bread and butter of good child psychologists helping kids with these types of anxieties through real life exposure, though, not just talking therapy. It's homework time. You got to break down.
Get in there, right? You have to experience it.
Yep. So
sensory experience.
That's a common thing to go after. When you're asking, hey, what else do we do besides medication? And then there's your whole area of expertise, Wendy, the educational care. Nothing more important than making the child is in the best learning environment possible, and that their profile is understood, and that the approach to education in the classroom, and if necessary with supports outside the classroom, is really customized for that child. Nothing more important than the work you do on that front.
Well, thank you. That's definitely a compliment. And that was really going to be my next question. And so I appreciate you adding that in there. And it is, and really looking at how do we hone in, how do we understand that child, and, you know, ensuring that the folks that are working with that student and that child understand the complex profile and really acknowledging and empathizing with that child, so that in turn we can really ensure that that child's being supported, in the classroom, whether it's with an IEP, a 504, just accommodations that may work best for that child. So have you kind of in your experience seen or heard things that have worked especially well in supporting students with a complex profile?
The piece that often gets underattended is the social piece. The in schools we emphasize reading, writing, arithmetic, and in an IEP, you have to show educational impact, right? It has to affect availability for learning, but done properly, With autism, what's the core disability? Well, it's social difficulty with peer interaction. And if you're not successful on the playground, in the lunchroom, it'll carry over and affect, your mood in the classroom. And there's a lot of important group learning that goes on in school, where you partner up, or you're doing small group projects, or you're just learning how to participate in an appropriate way in a classroom discussion. So I just want to get out up front there that social skills development is often best done in a school environment. That can be one big social skills group all day long, built into your child's day. So we want to make sure we're customizing the support that a child gets for those technically non-academic parts of their profile, the social piece. But boy, do they have an impact on academic performance.
They really do. And there's been plenty of meetings where I've sat in and have tried to convey what you're saying just now in terms of customizing that support. Correct. You know, this may not be directly an education impact in the academic areas, but if the social skills are not accessible, what an impact that will have and does have. And really, we would love for our kiddos to be the best version of themselves and in and out of the classroom. And you're right. What better way in the area that they spend the majority of their day is in a classroom, in a school setting. So to really incorporate those goals for that child in that customized, individualized approach so that we can really hone in on those skills so that they can then learn to do that independently to the best of their ability and carry those skills with them once they leave the classroom, the academic setting, and go into the real world and eventually need to employ those skills in a job setting.
Yeah, well said. And so I guess what we're both driving at here for parents is truly look at the whole child. We're not just going to focus on ADHD, not just going to focus on anxiety, not just going to focus on social ability, not just on different aspects of their academic learning profile. We really need to look at the whole package. And I'll get one other resource on my website, what I call the Gander, which is, all this is free on the website. It's a developmental assessment tool where you go down and look at each aspect of your child's profile. What's a big deal for my child and what's a medium deal, what's a little deal? And then once you've got your child's whole profile laid out in front of you, then you can ask, well, what is it about my child's profile that makes this part of the day hard or easy? And that guides management. Where do the problem situations come from? So if you go to parentchildjourney.com yet again and go to programs, and then journey, and you scroll down and you'll find the Gander, and you just hit on that, and that's the back half for free of my book, Parent Child Journey, that I hope gets parents thinking as diagnostic splitters, not lumpers. Just one diagnosis explains everything.
That's right, and it really is a nice way for parents. Where should they start if they're feeling overwhelmed, to give them that platform to really look at all avenues, to look at the whole child, to then be able to say, all right, how do I create a team for my child? How do I customize this team? And then really bringing somebody in that can help do that navigation of care and that case management piece as well to support that child. And so a lot of fantastic resources on your page and also in your most recent book, The Parent-Child Excursion, ADHD, Anxiety, and Autism, has a ton of information out there as well.
Thanks.
So do you have any final words you'd love to share?
Well, I guess we've had a good discussion here about complexity. It can be overwhelming, though, for parents. It usually is overwhelming. And I really do want to emphasize the importance of finding one person who can, you know, help you along your way. And if you have a child with a diagnosis of autism, there are a number of autism self-advocacy and national advocacy groups with parent support groups, with ADHD. CHAD and other groups provide wonderful support for anxiety. Most psychology practices, certainly in the greater Washington area, and for social skills, offer support groups not just for children, but for parents as well. So one thing I hear from parents over and over again is they feel like they're all alone in this. You don't have to be. Right. I think you seek out birds of the same feather and for crying out loud, everybody, let's flock together and right. help each That's other right. out.
It's true. And really to that support, you know, it's a systems approach, I always say, in terms of that family and the impact that it can have on the entire family. So finding folks that have been through a similar experience that can be equally as supportive and share resources is just priceless. Really is for families so that they can feel like they're heard, that they're supported, and really to be able to access resources and direction as well in their area that can really make this a great day for their families and their kiddos.
Well said. Well, thank you, Wendy. It's good talking with you, and I hope this is helpful.
Oh my gosh, Dr. Shapiro, such a pleasure. I just enjoyed every moment of it, and I appreciate your time coming on this morning and talking us through this complex world of ADHD, anxiety, and autism, and really kind of guiding families and professionals on how to start and how to support. So I appreciate it, and I hope you have a fantastic day.
Thank you. You too.
Thank you for joining us today for our IEP Essentials Pro Tips podcast. To hear more pro tips and find additional IEP essentials, including our IEP webinar, please visit www.learningessentialsedu.com.